this, it slows down also.
What?
Well, because, you know, we're using computer power for class.
Oh, I see.
You're copying your, you got an illegal copy of the OED.
PUBG? You're paying for it, my brother and I also
okay, so now, Brahma, it says, thus, once upon a time, Ekada, one time, Lord, the forefather of living entities, the Prajapati, and the father of religious principles, the religiousness, Dharmapati, Lord Brahma, described in both of them, situated himself in acts of regulative principles, desiring self-interest for the welfare of all living entities. When he says self-interest, this swartha, swartha. Here is the famous text, often quoted, the first line by Prabhupada, Mate vidu swartha gatim nidishnu. They do not know that one's own self-interest, or your real interest, is Vishnu. So this is the swa-artha. So when he says desiring self-interest, you could say the best interest of the welfare of all living entities. Therefore, he situated himself in this. See, niyama and yama. In the yoga, these first thing, yama and niyama. Things you shouldn't do, things you should do. So it's interesting that he was doing that. So Prabhupada talks about one cannot be situated in an exalted position without having undertaken a regulative life of rules and regulations. He desired the welfare of all as servants of God. So he probably concludes, the pure devotee of the Lord, like Brahma and persons in the chain of Pacific succession, do not do anything to instruct their subordinates without acting accordingly themselves. Well, he's setting this example also. And he's able to do this because of following these principles of self-control. So this talks about Brahma, and then he goes on to describe Narada. Narada, the most dear of the inheritor sons of Brahma, always ready to serve his father, strictly follows the instructions of his father by his mannerly behavior. Shila means good behavior. Meekness. Prayashraya. You know what that means? It means leaning forward. You know?
Bowed like this, you know?
Prayashraya. And Dhamma, sense control. So meekness means submissiveness, really. Submissive way. Those are his good qualities. Continues now, Narada, very much pleased his father and desired to know all about the energies of Vishnu, the master of all energies. For Narada was the greatest of all sages and the greatest of devotees. He's Mahabhagavata, Mahamuni. So he wanted to know all about the Maya, of Vishnu, who is Mayesha, the Lord of Maya. There's a purport here. Now, he says here, he's among the sons of Brahma, several well-known sons, Daksha, Satushana, and Narada. In the three departments of human knowledge disseminated by the Vedas, namely fruitive work, which is called the Karma Kanda, Kanda means section or division, transcendental knowledge, the Jnana Kanda, and devotional service called Upasana Kanda. Narada, Devarshi Narada, inherited from his father Brahma devotional service. So he is empowered, it is described as being the Shaktivesh avatar, empowered with Bhakti Shakti, the potency of devotional service. Whereas Daksha inherited from his father fruitive work. He's the big... Prabhupada says Daksha means expert in sex life. But in other places he's expert in sacrifice. He's a technician of sacrifice. And that's his thing, is performing sacrifice. And you notice there's this conflict between, several times, between Narada and Daksha. And then Narada and Lord Shiva also, all based on the Bhagavatam takes a dim view of these people who are Vedavada Rataha. They're dedicated to the words of the Vedas, but they don't really say, they say there's nothing more than this. That's Daksha. And Sanaka Sanatan inherited from their father information about Jnanakanda, or transcendental knowledge. They are Brahma bodies, they are not Maya bodies. But originally they are Maya bodies, and then when they finally... They're Brahma bodies, they're situated in Brahman realization. And see what happens when I miss my nap? They're situated in Brahman realization. Then of course they have some contact with the Lord and develop a relationship of affection for him in Shantaras. But they are actually the Jnanakanda. They also are the founders of one Sampradaya and devotees. Yeah, Prabhupada here is used to include both. But ultimately, if you understand demigod worship, it's also worship of the Lord. Yeah. Devotional service, he puts in with the Upasana Kanda.
Why is Upasana Kanda supposed to be demigod worship?
Yeah, the Upasana Kanda also does include, described as including demigod worship, worship of the devatas. No, Karma Kanda technically includes ritual sacrifices, not puja.
But they're sacrifices which the devas aren't both.
What?
In those sacrifices, the devas aren't both. I mean, they've got all the,
Yeah, so is Vishnu. Does that make a devotional service? It's really a different division, even though Vishnu and the devatas are mentioned. The point is the sacrifice in the Karma Kanda section. If you understand the meaning of sacrifice, if you really get into it, if you really know what the whole purport of sacrifice, you also understand Krishna consciousness. So, but many don't. They don't go any further, and they're called devotees of the Karma Kanda section. If you really understand, if you're really a jnani, and you really reach real jnan, mam prapajjate, he surrenders to me. If you really understand the worship of the Devatas, you know what's really going on, you become a Krishna Bhakta. You don't bother with them.
Yes, as my candidate, it's, this part which worships demigods, as a still worship, for which purpose? Which purpose is the worship?
For material things.
So that means the karmis.
In a sense, they're like karmis, yes. They're worshipped for sense gratification.
Yeah. How does non-ashram dharma fit into those three categories?
Offering. It's another way of looking at things, but varnashram dharma is also sometimes called sanatana dharma. It's another thing that is taught in the Vedas everywhere. It's just sort of assumed, actually. This is what you do. But then, of things you call like dharma, artha, kama, and moksha, in a way, dharma is karma kanda, jnana kanda, and upasana kanda. And usually these are all brahminical activities. Even though they're not all transcendentalists, they all are brahminical activities. But sometimes, quite often, performed on behalf of others. The priest performs sacrifice for the king, for this or that. He's the yajamana, the one who pays for it, and therefore who gets the results of the sacrifices.
It's the other way. I mean, we would really say that karma kanda, jnana kanda, upasana kanda are part of varnashram dharma.
Well, you could say that, except that at least for bhakti, it exists independently of that too. I mean, even in the jnana kanda, you know, sannyasis, which we think of as part of varnashram dharma, in some ways they, when you take sannyas, your will is read and your brahman thread is taken off. You become a dead person legally. If you're dead, you're outside of the system. It's not the way it is in ISKCON, of course. And you wander off somewhere and nobody knows what happens to you. You leave your village, you know. You can imagine how heavy it is in like a place where everybody, you know, is rooted in a village and never goes, you know, 20 miles outside of the village, you know.
That's not
this contract. Huh?
That's not this contract.
No. It's not. But otherwise, yeah, in sannyas, as one of the ashrams, it's a new body. The designation. Sarva upadi vinaya mukta, but bhakti. Higher than that upadi. So anyway, those are the three divisions: karma, jnana, and bhakti. Which several places Prabhupada does this. He puts this as the upasana kanda. There isn't anything described ever as the bhakti kanda. There's the upasana.
Is upasana kanda samhita kanda also?
Huh?
Is upasana kanda and samhita kanda the same?
And?
Samhita kanda.
Samhita?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's... No, but that's another...
Samhita kanda?
Yeah.
That would, if anything, be the karma kanda.
Yeah,
because the samhitas and the brahmanas, the instructions for the rituals,
the
sacrifices are not there. It's in the Upanishads and the Arambikas.
The Vedas are the Samhitas, which are the things that you chant when you do a sacrifice. The Brahmanas are the instructions for following sacrifice. Then when you go to the forest, then you can't perform sacrifice anymore. And so then there's instructions for performing these things by meditation and thinking about sacrifice and how to live in the forest as a vanaprastha aranyaka. And then after that is the Upanishads. So the Upanishads and you know, like the Brihat Aranyaka is an Upanishad, but it's, you know, sort of on the border.
Which is anyway part of the Shatapatha Brahmana.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Some chapters
from a certain Brahmana is the Brihat Aranyaka. So this is a development from the Karmakanda into again, you know, for those who have renounced the world and everything like that, you know, just Jnana Kanda, but also Bhakti is in there too. But then Bhakti sort of goes back. What you see in Bhakti is that the search for transcendence in Bhakti is back into the village. It's domesticated. You can do bhakti while you stay at home. You can do bhakti while you're on the battlefield. You don't have to be this, you know, renounced religious specialist. You can be an ordinary person and do bhakti. Yeah.
You mentioned that these priests, they make him sacrifice on behalf of kings.
And others, yeah, whoever pays for it.
you mean they paid, not really.
Yeah, yes, he called the Yajamana the sponsor of the sacrifice. So who distributes dakshin to the Brahmins?
They also get benefit out of this sacrifice. The priests.
The priests, they get benefit? No, the benefit goes to the Yajamana. The result, you do a sacrifice because the king wants a son.
You
do a sacrifice to get something, or to go to the heavenly planets or whatever, you know. So, I mean, the Brahmins certainly do it for themselves, but they do it for others also. And sometimes it's not just for the heavenly planets. It's to win a war, to get a good online connection, all kinds of things.
to get a son
that can kill
the
Brahmins. Yeah, you see this.
When we chant Hare Krishna, it's also yajna. So we can chant it for somebody else and then we don't get benefit, or how it works with Bhakti Yoga.
Bhakti Yoga, you also get a benefit, sure.
You can do it for somebody else?
Yeah, you can, sure. And yeah, of course you know.
But the person also gets a benefit.
Yeah, if you do, because you're praying to Krishna, please help this person. And if Krishna thinks, well, you've done so much for me, I'll do something for you, I'll help this person.
Why not?
Help them in devotional service, of course. From the testimony that I've heard from my congregation, chanting the Hare Krishna mantra gives two benefits: love of God and parking places. I went to chant anyway, found a parking place. Okay, so of these three sons, but Narada is described here as the most beloved son of Brahma, because of all these good qualities that are mentioned. And Prabhupada then sells us a little bit, because why he's famous as the greatest of sages, because of being the greatest of devotees and the spiritual master of famous devotees, Prahlad, Dhruva, Vyas, down to the Kirata hunter, whose name we call Madrari, which just means the enemy of animals.
This is his real name.
I don't know. Kirata is his tribe. It's a tribal name. Kirata, Hunandra, Pulandra.
Yeah.
I always think of those four people getting together.
So it's the animal hunter Kirata.
Vigari.
I don't know, here he's called Kirata, which is the tribal name. Another kind of thing is called Vigari, which means enemy of that wild animals. In Sanskrit, there's two groups of animals, Mriga, which are wild animals, and Pashu, which are domestic animals. So he's enemy of the wild animals. So therefore, all these features of Narada make him the dearmost son of his father, and all of this is due to Narada's being a first-class devotees. The devotees are always anxious to know more and more about the Supreme Lord. And here another one describing this from one of the four verses of the Bhagavad Gita. They're like this, Bodhyanta Parasparam. They're always conversing about me, enlightening one another. Their minds are fixed to me, and making their very life. They're talking always and enjoying themselves and feeling great bliss. Because the Lord is unlimited and His energies also, no one can know that completely, but you keep wanting to know more and more and more and more and more. So even though Brahma knows more than anyone, still the knowledge is not complete. So here we have this disciplic succession with Narada being very qualified son. And then says, the great sage Narada also inquired about in detail from his father, Brahma, the great grandfather of the universe, after seeing him well satisfied. So Narada Prabhupada has this interesting remark here. The process of understanding spiritual or transcendental knowledge from the realized person is not exactly asking an ordinary question from the schoolmaster. The schoolmasters in the modern day are paid agents for giving some information. But the spiritual master is not a paid agent. And so, therefore, the process is different. Although, I would have to say, when I first understood having spent a lot of time in academics, both as taught and teacher, when I understood the relationship between the spiritual master and the disciple, I realized what incredible good situation it creates for the transmission of knowledge. It really is fantastic. Because, I explain this, so then here's the process. You have to approach the spiritual masters with pranipat, by falling down before, by inquiring from them, and by service, and they can enlighten you because they are tattva-darshinis. Surrender, questions, and service. Receiving transcendental knowledge is not like exchanging dollars. Now, and then again, Yasya Devi, he quotes, we've already talked about this Svetashvatara Upanishad verse, only unto one who has unflinching devotion to the Lord. So this is the requirement for this knowledge to shine forth. Such relationship between the disciple and the spiritual master is eternal. One who is now the disciple is the next spiritual master. This is parampara. One thing is, that's one way you pay back. You're receiving such knowledge for somebody, you don't pay him the money, but you owe him. An obligation has been created on your part for having received such knowledge. So you give service. Service means, what do you want me to do? And that service is to distribute the knowledge others. So one who's now the disciple is the next spiritual master. This is parampara. And one cannot be a bona fide and authorized spiritual master unless one has been strictly obedient to his spiritual master. So let me just mention this. You know, in my all the careers I had with in academics, you know, I maybe had a few teachers from whom I really learned something. And it didn't really matter what the field was, but somehow or other, I was able to get into a relation to this. You know, the teacher's there and they're going through the routine, but something they had to offer or say became very, very interesting to me. And I would go up and ask questions afterwards. And the teacher would see that I was eager to learn. And what, usually if they're real teachers and they see somebody really wants to know, they start talking. And if the teacher is somebody who really has mastery of the subject matter, I mean real mastery, who can take something in some field of knowledge and do it really, really well. You know, they're like maestros. Or say when you learn a musical instrument, you know, I mean, you see somebody who really knows what they're doing, it looks like a miracle. You know, how did this person attain this level of skill? And if you have a teacher like that and you're really eager to learn and maybe you have some talent too in the material case, they can they become merciful. And it means like somehow or other out of them sometimes they'll just say something or show you something that reveals the whole thing. You know, it's hard to give a concrete example now. But you know, you'll be really interested in those showing something. Now how do I understand this poem? You know, how do you really read it? And they say, oh, like, and suddenly, you know, you understand how to do it. Not just this poem, but any poem, any way of understanding it. It's a skill in action, and you just have to see it. And somebody just has to show it. And you see somebody who's a master do that, you know, then something is really transmitted, even in a mundane context. And that's why people know this. So in even in India, when you're learning something even material, not just spiritual, still this relationship was there. You know, your music teacher, your dance instructor, your grammar teacher, you treated them like this. And actually it's very, very good for the transmission of knowledge. And of course, any of these, you know, in the traditional sense, if they were brahmanas teaching, they did not get a fee. They didn't ask for a fee at all. Wasn't that kind of relationship. So anyway, I think this is really... So this idea of the spiritual master and the disciple, it's really the student-teacher relationship, and it comes into its really own, you know, when it hits the transcendental level. Because and what it talks about is one needs the blessings of the spiritual master. One needs the blessings of the spirit. And he says, when the spiritual master sees the genuine, in the purport to this verse, Tadvidhi Pranipatena, the prophet says, when the spiritual master sees the genuine desire of the disciple, he automatically blesses the disciple with real spiritual understanding. So there's this thing you call a blessing. Now, in the Krishna conscious case, that means that Krishna is involved in this too. Or maybe the super soul is involved in any case, I don't know, but in this case, really Krishna now he wants to talk about the, at least when we come to when we come to spiritual knowledge, Prabhupada says the so-called formality is the relation between the cheater and the cheated. Actually, you see it now even in the mundane educational system when it's deteriorated. The teachers don't really know anything. They've slogged their way through some kind of education degree, and now they're in a school which they hate, teaching students that they hate, with a subject matter they don't care about. So they go through the motions, and the students, they just get promoted automatically to get rid of them. So it says education is going on, but really nothing happens. So the cheater and the cheated, Prabhupada says this, in this context, somebody wants something, but they do not really wish to pay the price. So the person who is the cheat, then he says later, I was cheated, I didn't get it. It's a typical the way it works with a con artist. There's a famous American con artist that he was asked, you know, a con artist, you know, somebody who deceives people and steals their money by saying, here's this investment, you know, you give me this money, I'm going to invest it here, and you're going to get, you know, 100% return on your money. And he convinces people of all this, and they all give him his money, and he disappears, you know. A confidence game, otherwise known as a con artist. You get people's confidence and then cheat them. He said that the great confidence artist in America said, I never cheated an honest person. And this is how it worked. In the Philadelphia airport, one of our competitors, when we were doing book distribution, there were these guys who were selling watches. And they would stop people. This was in the old days, you could do things like this, but they would stop people. And they would open up their coats or something, or pull up their watches. They had watches, you know. And take them aside and offer them to sell them. The watch says Rolex. And they're going to give you this Rolex watch, which normally sells for $2,500. For $200. And you want to know, well, wait a minute, how can I get a $2,500 watch for just $200? So this question comes up, he sees your doubt, and then the guy very cleverly lets you understand that these are stolen watches and they have to get rid of them quickly. So, okay, now you're getting a chance to get this watch, you know, for $200. And then it doesn't last but a week, you know, because it's knockoff. Why you were cheated? You go, I was cheated. These guys cheated. Bolex, they cheated me. But you're the cheater. You wanted something for nothing. So this is the relationship. So when people get cheated, and the spiritual thing, they go to somebody and say, I want a Brahman, I want a spiritual realization, I want to realize how it's all one. And the guy says, you know, they tell you you have to follow regular principles and be strict, you'll go away. So they just say, you know, give me $200, take this mantra, chant it for one, you know. And nothing happens. It's the same situation, the cheater and the cheated. The other example that Prabhupada gives is that sometimes in the olden days in India, maybe not so old, maybe they still do it, they would go to places, women would go to places where the yogis are gathering, practicing their austerities, because they would understand that if they could have a son by one of these yogis, it would be a very powerful son because of their Urdhva Rita and everything, and celibacy, that some of you know, potent because they had tejas, you know. So they go to these places to seduce a yogi. When people realized that this was happening, guys would go pretending to be yogis.
I'm
now, so here we're talking about now the qualification for spiritual realization, being a disciple, and being a disciple means being spiritual master. But when he says, one who is now the disciple is the next spiritual master. So actually the qualifications for discipleship and the qualifications for spiritual master are really the same. And Prabhupada makes this clear. One who, Narada Muni, was self-controlled. One who is not self-controlled, specifically in sex life, can become neither a disciple nor a spiritual master. One must have disciplinary training in controlling speaking, anger, the tongue, the mind, the belly, and the genitals. This is, he's of course referring to the first verse of Nectar of Instruction. One who has controlled the particular senses mentioned above is called a Goswami. Without becoming a Goswami, one can become neither a disciple nor a spiritual master. So he says that twice. The so-called spiritual master without sense control is certainly the cheater, and the disciple of such a so-called spiritual master is the cheater. I've marked this off. Here, this is Prabhupada's introduction to the preface, rather, to Nectar of Instruction, which is really a kind of commentary on the first verse. In all spiritual affairs, one's first duty is to control his mind and senses. Unless one controls his mind and senses, one cannot make any advancement in spiritual life. Everyone within this material world is engrossed in the modes of passion and ignorance. One must promote himself to the platform of goodness, sattva guna, by following the instructions of Rupa Goswami, the author of Nectar of Instruction. And then everything, listen to this sentence, and then just come to the platform of goodness when you're on this particular path, and then everything concerning how to make further progress will be revealed. That's a far out statement. Then he continues, advancement in Krishna consciousness depends upon the attitude of the follower. A follower of the Krishna consciousness movement should become a perfect Goswami. Vaishnavas are generally known as Goswamis. So it's not just, you know, this Das Goswami Maharaj, you know. Everybody's supposed to be Goswami. In Vrindavan, this is the title by which the director of each temple is known. One who wants to become a perfect devotee of Krishna must become a Goswami. Go means the senses. The Swami means the master. Unless one controls his senses and mind, one cannot become a Goswami. To achieve the highest success in life by becoming a Goswami and then a pure devotee of the Lord, one must follow the instructions known as Upadesh Amrita, which have been given by Srila Rupa Goswami. So really that's a comment in Vajra Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Jiva Vegam, Udra Pasta Vegam, which he cites here. And then he can become, that verse says, and that person can accept disciples everywhere. Any questions about that text here? So that's Narada. He's qualified in this way. Thereupon the supplementary Vedic literature, Bhagavatam Puranam, which was described by the personality of Godhead. Bhagavata Proktam. And which contains 10 characteristics. This is the word Dasha Lakshanam. 10 indicators or signs features. Was told, this is the 10 topics, this is in the next chapter, was told with satisfaction by the father Brahma to his son Narada. So satisfaction means satisfied with Narada. But yeah, he says that Bhagavatam will be explained the 10 characteristics 10 topics.
Is that the Dasmola?
Hmm?
That's the Dasmola?
No.
No?
No, it's different.
Okay.
Bhagavatam contains 10 topics. Usually a Purana contains 5, but this is a Mahapurana, so it has 10. Mm-hmm.
The type of letter through the 17,996, it should be.
What?
It's not really important.
17,996, right? Mm-hmm. 4 verses, right? 6 and 4, right? Okay.
No one will really care about
18,000 verses, and you add 4. What do you do? You add 4, you're too short.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing to write to the BBT about.
But the Lord actually spoke 6 verses.
Seven. He says the Lord spoke only 4 verses, and that therefore the rest of the day, right, is too.
Just to bewilder Pentecost.
A question about the Chaturasloki. Who actually established it as the Chaturasloki? It's not in the Bhagavatam text itself. What are the acharyas supposed to say? This is.
Do you know the answer to that question? I don't know.
Sridhar Swami.
Probably Sridhar Swami, yeah. Probably. He's the first commentator, and if he did it.
Well, he's the first. He's actually, Madhva was even supposedly before him.
What?
Madhva, I think, is actually. He's the first commentator on. First commentator whose commentary is existent today.
On the Bhagavatam.
Yeah, but there were others before him.
Before Madhva.
Well, Madhva was before Sridhar a little bit. His commentary is incomplete, but there were others before.
Why, of course, for us, really for us, we follow Mahaprabhu. And Mahaprabhu says Sridhar Swami is like the authoritative commentator on the Bhagavatam. That freaks people out, some people, like mudbites. Because Sridhar Swami was a member of a Mayavada Sampradaya. Yeah, that's true. But somehow Sridhar Swami was more. He didn't split off like Madhva did, you know. He stayed with them. And apparently, I don't know, I just read a few scholars, there were he was always in difficulty because of his admitting the personal existence of the Lord with his community in this. Have you heard that? Anyway, I read it somewhere.
Oh, Sridhar.
Yeah. There was some controversy about it. And Sridhar is important because Sridhar Swami is important because Mahaprabhu said so. really, our touchstone for everything is Mahaprabhu and what he taught the 6 Goswamis. And because he accepts Sridhar, because he accepts Madhva, that's how. Because he's the Lord himself, you know. He could really start things up by himself. But he preferred, because he's coming as a devotee, he takes his place in the Sampradaya, and so on.
To Sridhar Swami's reference to it, he sort of assumed it's naturally understood that this is the Chaturasloki. He doesn't do anything to establish it as such.
He just says it is.
Just as in this Chaturasloki, as if everyone already.
Okay, so it may have been current before him, that idea. Okay. So Prabhupada just in this purport, he makes a parallel. Just as this was spoken in 4 verses, then it was expanded. So then he says, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed this to Rupa Goswami in a nutshell, but the disciple Rupa Goswami expanded this very elaborately, and the same subject was further expanded by Jiva Goswami and even further by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. We are just trying to follow in the footsteps of all these authorities. So Srimad Bhagavatam is not like ordinary fiction and or mundane literature. It is unlimited in strength. And however one may expand it according to one's own ability, Bhagavatam still cannot be finished by such expansion. Srimad Bhagavatam, being the sound representation of the Lord, is simultaneously explained in 4 verses and in 4 billion verses all the same, inasmuch as the Lord is smaller than the atom and bigger than the unlimited sky. Such is the potency of Srimad Bhagavatam. I meant to mark this, and I don't think we're interrupted, but I was preparing. But that's a great, really nice a statement here of him. How it was expanded, and now Prabhupada is doing the same, and it could go on expanding. So that's why, if you think, you know, how could it be done in a nutshell in 4 verses, and what about this expansion process? Is that legitimate? This is the answer from here. Prabhupada's nice statement. Oops. What did I do? I'm going to mark that. That's really, really worth remembering, this one. Now,
just this number, because some thoughts that we often say that pure devotee never makes mistakes. So, and obviously we see that Prabhupada apparently, or we can perceive something a mistake, but how to reconcile these things?
Well, Prabhupada was asked this question.
He was asked this question.
Because they said, sometimes we see the spiritual master seems to make a mistake, forgets a verse, or misquotes. A lot of times Prabhupada quotes a verse and it's not exactly, all these things, these little inadvertences. So what does it mean? And Prabhupada says, when they say a spiritual master perfect, is that he is perfect in spreading Krishna consciousness. Not that he is perfect like God. It's in the folio. There's a morning walk. I could track it down for you. But that's what he says. Not that he is perfect like God. It's a reasonable thing. For the perfect is perfect in spreading Krishna consciousness. These little things can happen. See, it didn't really in any way impede our realization of Krishna consciousness that this thing is 2 members off, except for maybe you.
So anyway,
we want you to understand this.
The sentence in the previous text, does it also explain why in higher planetary systems the Bhagavatam has more canto?
Yeah. The Jiva Goswami, somewhere it's in the Sandarbhas, the exact proportion, one point I figured it out, because the Vedas is bigger by a certain factor, and if you multiply by that factor, it may be 4 billion, I don't remember what the number is, but in one of the Sandarbhas, Jiva Goswami talks about how much more Vedas is available in the heavenly planets than here. But it keeps getting bigger. That's the point here. So now, it says here, in succession, O King, the great sage Narada instructed Srimad Bhagavatam unto the unlimitedly powerful Vyasadeva, who meditated in devotional service upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, and the bank of the river Saraswati. Well, we've been there. We've already encountered this particular incident of Narada explaining to Vyas, 1st Canto, 5th Chapter. Which explains about Brahma, I mean, about Vyasadeva. And Narada here asks him, I ask you to meditate upon the activities of the personality of Godhead, whose activities are unparalleled. Because we understand, remember, Vyasadeva was despondent. He'd done so many works. He was still feeling unfulfilled. And he thought to himself, maybe I didn't talk enough about the activities of the Lord. And not sure what to do. And then Narada shows up and rebukes him and tells him that this is what you should do. You meditate upon the activities of the Lord and then you bring them out again. So this is the history of how Bhagavatam came to be produced down here. Otherwise, because it's rahasyam, it's guhyatamam, and so on, he may be a little reluctant to bring this forth in such a way. So here he says that Narada, in the specific session, also certifies Vyas. He certified the qualities of Srila Vyas as fixed in the absolute truth with great vow. And so you're mentioning that realizing Krishna in this text, the word is Brahma Paramam, the supreme Brahman. And so this is Krishna's position, and then he quotes from the Bhagavad Gita, Param Brahma Param Dhamma. This is Arjuna's realization before he sees the universal form. After hearing the course central verses of Bhagavad Gita, his response to Krishna is, you are the supreme Brahman. Not just Brahman, but Param Brahman. If there's a Param Brahman, there must be a Brahman that's not Param too. And then Arjuna says, it's not just me, because I'm your friend I say this, but also, and he leads the list with Devarshi Narada, he says it too. So that when Vyasa described as fixing his mind in meditation, he did it in Bhakti Yoga, and saw the supreme, together with his energies and so on, that's described in this. I thought I put a link to there, but I don't see it now. He actually saw the Supreme Person with Maya, the illusory energy, in contraposition. And Prabhupada, it says here, the Lord's Maya is also a representation because Maya has no existence without the Lord. Darkness is not independent of light. Without light, no one can experience the contraposition of darkness. However, this Maya or illusion cannot overcome the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but stands apart from Him, apashraya. That's in the earlier text in the fifth chapter. Okay, I think, is this the final text? Yeah. Okay, we're just at the end now. So, O King, your question as to how the universe became manifested. Remember, we go back to the question of King Parikshit. This is all answering his question, isn't it? From the gigantic form of the Personality of Godhead, as well as other questions, I shall answer in detail by explanation of the four verses already mentioned. So his answer...
Does it say four verses?
I don't think it says so in the word for word. Yeah, he doesn't say that. Prabhupada puts that in.
Oh, so you're thinking maybe it's a question of that existence, like chapter 12.
Yeah, no, it's not mentioned as such in the, he doesn't say the four verses here. Prabhupada adds that in. Because I'm sure it's in the commentators, and a lot of times Prabhupada puts the commentators into the verse. And he mentions about Bhagavatams. All questions that can be humanly possible regarding the universal affairs beginning from its creation are all answered in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I just had a meeting today we're starting to, I'm the director of the Vedic Planetarium Research Project. Figure it out. We got to find all the answers in the Bhagavatam. So all questions that can be humanly possible regarding the universal affairs beginning from creation. I had these things marked and other things, and somehow or other they didn't get saved. Somehow I shut down the computer or something. I forgot to save them. But this was another thing. Beginning from its creation are all answered in Srimad Bhagavatam. This is why Prabhupada thought we could, from Bhagavatam we can make this planetarium, because the answers are there.
Is the planetarium only going to go as far as the material world, or is it going to go all the way up to Krishna world?
Yeah, the whole thing.
How big is it going to be?
Huh?
How big is it going to be?
No, it'll keep you busy for a few days.
Is it going to be the scale? 3/4 will be the spiritual world then?
Yeah, you can't do it to scale, unfortunately. The 10 divisions of Srimad Bhagavatam, as explained by the great speaker Srila Sukadeva Goswami, are the limitation of all questions. And intelligent persons will derive all intellectual benefits from them by proper utilization. Whoa. See, just when I'm wondering, should we count, is this possible? Here's the answer, right there in front of me. Proper utilization. The answers depend only on the qualification of the person who explains them. All questions that can be humanly possible regarding the universal affairs beginning from his creation are all answered in Srimad Bhagavatam. Boy, there it is. Okay, that's that chapter. That's the end of chapter 9. And tomorrow, I guess we cover the 10 questions, the 10 topics rather, not the 10 questions. 10 subject matter covered by Srila Prabhupada. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.